And our goal is simple. Give these people a convenient, tasty, affordable, easy solution.
Well, Bo, I want to thank you, first of all, for coming here this early morning.
Sure.
To be on the podcast. And it was interesting meeting you the other night at that event.
Yeah.
That was, it's called the,
Delphi Network.
Delphi
Network. Is what it's called.
Was that your first time coming?
Yes. Yeah.
That was my first time, too. Let's start off, first of all, Bo, where were you born?
In the U.S.
So, in the U.S.
Actually, the name of the city was Davenport, Iowa. Even though I was born there, I only lived there to the age of four.
Okay.
And then because of my father's work, my whole family relocated to Waterloo, Belgium, or kind of around the Brussels area.
How many siblings do you have?
Just one younger sister.
How many years difference?
3.5.
Are you guys close?
3.5. You know, my sister's personality and mine are just such opposite sides of the spectrum.
Uh-huh.
So I feel like we have a great sibling relationship. I do think because we grew up abroad in that, in such a unique childhood, unique environment, we did share so many amazing experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think we have a great relationship even to this day.
What kind of business was your father in?
So he worked for one of the world's largest food ingredients manufacturers.
Okay.
For actually two different companies, and he actually grew up mostly on a farm in Iowa. So the Becker family was, or it still is, farmers in Iowa. Now they've gone quite more industrial than it was back
then.
What
were they doing? What did they start off doing?
Yeah, corn, soybeans,
okay.
Cows,
okay.
Pigs. You know the whole. We're talking about real farms, real farm and. So my father grew up in a very humble environment. And
what about your mother?
My father was just one of the first from his family to really go to university, pursue that education, and it led to this great career that I'm so proud of, and just enabled my sister and I to have a great childhood, and in many senses allowed me to do this crazy startup that I do now. But my mother, she's also from Iowa, right? My family grew up there. My grandfather worked for AT&T, who was such an amazing man, unfortunately passed away a few years ago. But he was working for AT&T for a long career, gave them a great childhood. My mother and uncles are just all such bright. Every year our family Christmas is just such an event.
That's good.
And my grandparents ended up retiring to Las Vegas. And so after a life in Iowa, my grandfather just said, I'm done with the winters. I'm done with this, with these small towns. We're going to Vegas. And then, so from my childhood, from basically age 2 to 20-something, we would be in Las Vegas with my grandparents every year for Christmas. I mean, it was just such a
coming from Belgium.
Basically, yeah.
How long did you live in Belgium?
Yeah, so
until
10 years out of my childhood.
Years.
So it was basically age 4 to 10, so all of my elementary school.
Okay.
And then we moved back to the U.S. For a few years, lived in rural Illinois, where food ingredients are made. And then from age 14 to 18, we were back in Belgium, so my high school as well. And unbelievably, I was actually at the same international school for both of those stints. So some of the friends were there, and even, it's just so crazy to think, but my kindergarten teacher was able to attend my high school graduation, even though it was in Belgium, right? So, there were a couple of the students that I had gone to kindergarten with, even though it was that far away, and so.
And they came too?
Well, no, they were part of the same
class.
They were in my high school graduating
class.
Yeah. So, yeah, I had quite a wild childhood. So, in fact, if you ask me where I'm from, it's one of the hardest questions for me to answer,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I was, 10, so far in my life, it's been 10 years in Belgium, 12 years in the U.S., and then now 10 years in Asia.
Were you, you were at an international school while you were in Belgium?
Absolutely, yeah.
So you only speak English?
Yeah, and that's one of my regrets looking back. So I took French classes for 10 years while I was there, but everyone around me was speaking English, all my friends were English, and
it's something about
I never picked it up as like, I did speak, but I never really,
put yourself into it.
Embraced it.
And you didn't have to.
No, not at all.
Being in international school. So you had the compounds too for everyone? Was it set up like that, or were you pretty much integrated with the community?
We were totally living on a Belgian street, cobblestone street. All the neighbors were Belgian. I mean, so my French was not bad at the time. You know, I had no problem going around and conversing. My childhood was very Belgian in many senses. I mean, I remember my sister and I getting the Belgian waffles at the supermarket and loving that. And I mean, just really enjoying Belgian food. Whereas typical American kids would never be eating mussels and escargot and foie gras. Yeah, I mean, that's some of our favorite foods now. And I think the experience also changed my parents a lot.
In what way?
Well, I mean, my father grew up on a farm. You know, his parents never would have been drinking red wine and enjoying these amazing European dinners and going skiing. And now my father has become an absolute wine savant.
But where's he living now?
So my parents relocated to Denver 4 years ago. Yeah, so my father finally retired from his global C-suite job. I think he had just had enough after around 40 years or so in that role, and decided to join a startup company in Denver. And so they're having quite an adventure over there. But every year I'm going there now to visit them. Yeah,
and they go skiing in the winter and everything.
They might even be there this week. Yeah, every time I call them, they're saying, "Oh, we were just skiing all last weekend."
I'm just curious about this. So, what made you decide to come to Japan? I mean, but first,
yeah, sure.
You went to college in the States?
Yeah, so I had that Belgian upbringing, even though it was international school. But my family's all American, and I definitely had a desire to go to college in the U.S. I thought that the ultimate experience, the football games, the fraternities,
Were you playing sports like that in Belgium?
I played volleyball, basketball, and baseball all 4 years. I was a big sports guy in high school, and I did the academics, just a chronic overachiever. I can't
stop
myself.
Did you have your height? I mean, did you get your height as well when you were
younger?
Yeah,
now I'm 6'3". I was probably 6 foot or 6'1" by freshman year.
So you were always one of the taller in your class.
Absolutely. Never tall enough to really take it to a to a professional level, but enough to shine on the high school teams. Okay. But and so after that, I just had this desire to go to college in the U.S. I got accepted to Northwestern University, which was my dream school. It was in Chicago. It had amazing sports. It was that big feel with top academics. And I've got nothing bad to say about the experience at Northwestern. I mean, just a wonderful year as I studied mechanical engineering and economics. I mean, pushed myself way too hard, but
What did you plan on to do with it? What were your thoughts then in college?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. And I mean, the reason I chose mechanical engineering is that I always loved physics. I was always tinkering, taking stuff apart. I loved to build stuff. But around the age of 19, 20, I could already tell that this pure engineering was not for me. I was already struggling to engage with thermodynamics, with vector calculus, and I was doing them all, but just not really engaged in it as much. And I by that age, I already knew I wanted to be a businessman, and I could see I was good at engaging with people. I was good at selling. I was good at creating relationships. And so
why did you change from that into business? What really prompted the business thought?
It was totally a natural feeling from my personality.
Okay.
I was surrounded by all my engineering classmates, and I was also doing economics, so I would be around all these engineering classmates, and I would be the one standing out, like the most charismatic one, if we can say that. And then I would be among the economics class. I would feel much more at home, and then I was already trying to run some small businesses during university. Is way overtaxing myself, but I was all in with the business.
Do you have any people though, like, not mentors, but people that you looked up to that were in the business field that kind of inspired you in that direction, or did you have a professor or someone like that that made you think, Bo?
Yeah.
You are really charismatic. You'd be perfect. as a spokesman or a motivational
coach
or
it wasn't
a
that.
Businessman?
You know, what it was is I was involved with a company, or it's kind of a combination of a company and a student organization in university. The name of the organization is ISAC. And they also have it here in Japan, but it's basically a business platform that puts students into leadership positions, you know, from a young age. And I just, as soon as I got involved with that community, it really elevated me and showed me that I was meant to be in business, and okay. It really suited me. I loved leading teams. I loved setting goals, setting, you know, all of these boring business scheduling and organizing that people didn't like. I loved it. So, okay. Now I knew from that age. And you asked, how did I get involved with, you know, Japan and in Asia? And during my time at Northwestern, I did an internship in Beijing, and I did a small stint in Tokyo as well with the company I just mentioned. And I was just totally blown away at the time.
Wait, had you requested
Absolutely.
To do both?
Yes. Yeah. They were. I wanted to do them.
What was your interest prior to that, to want to come to Asia?
I think it was just the aspect of culture shock that really intrigued me. I really wanted to experience the cultures that were the furthest from what I had known growing up. And so I had so much exposure to European and American culture, and I knew those perfectly well. But somehow I just looked at, you know, East Asia as this black box that I just didn't understand. It's like, what? I was in my economics classes in university, and we were just talking about how China was exploding and how business was booming there. And I was fascinated. I said, what is going on over there?
Did you ever have any Asian friends?
Many, many.
During college?
Even during high school. Okay. A lot. I mean, on my baseball team, I
but
had
like
Japanese
from where?
Friends.
From where? Oh, Japanese?
Japanese, Chinese, Koreans, okay. Thai. I mean, right. Just to name a few. I really had a lucky childhood because I grew up, I mean, even in my elementary school, I had Asian friends from many backgrounds.
Right.
And then during university, because I was running this international company, I had lots of Chinese friends, lots of Korean friends, you know, some Japanese as well, Taiwanese. One of my best friends in college was from Taiwan.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I had always been interested, but it really was that just stark difference between the cultures that just grabbed me, and I thought.
So, what was it like for you when you landed? You went into China first.
Yeah.
What were your first thoughts when you
landed? Yeah, I remember it was during. I was 20 years old. I accepted a 3-month internship during the summer. I had no idea what to expect. Flew in. somebody from the university that was hosting me came to meet me. It was late at night. They put me in a hotel. The next morning, I just got up, totally jet lagged, and went for a walk outside on the street. And I remember the first thing that hit me was, holy cow, everybody's Chinese, right? And it's something you, growing up in Western countries, that you just cannot even imagine such a monoethnic society. And everyone was like kind of looking at me walking on the street, and I obviously stood out, and I was just like, wow, like this is quite an experience already. And just, yeah, so that was the first, you know, culture shock that grabbed me, but it was the way they ate, the way they thought. Everyone I met was saying, oh, you're from America. We got to start a business. We got to do a company. What can we import? And it was like,
What year was this?
2010, because okay, so it was the World Expo was in Shanghai.
That tells me you had a lot of visual information already. I'm sure you stayed up at nights looking at China and the different areas and the people and stuff like that. How would you say the difference is between intellectually knowing it and then truly emotionally being involved in it?
Yeah, it was just, it was
did it match
so
any
much
kind of
more.
Anything
than
that match?
Very little, to be honest. Because I also think there's that whole communist aspect where we grow up in Western schools learning about, you know, communism is the wrong way, and suddenly there you are in China. Lots of people are doing really well, right? You know, new buildings were going up on every corner. everyone was trying to start a business, and it's like, hold on.
Wait.
And then I, you know, and I'm coming from a economics class in Chicago where everyone's just trying to get a job at the biggest consulting firm, and that's their biggest ambition. And I'm thinking, hold on here, like there's a disconnect. Like, what's happening?
Bo, let me tell you what. That's you're echoing exactly what I felt in '74 when I came to Japan.
Yeah, a lot of people say that. 30 years behind. Yeah.
When I came here in '74. First of all, I was expecting people to be with rickshaws and grass hats.
Well, those were still in Beijing at the time.
But it was. No, you see, but very little of it.
Sure.
You know, it's not like what you expect. You know, I thought that would be the major, you know, means of transportation.
Not at all, no.
They had cabs then in '74. Yeah. The doors were automatic like they are now.
Sure, yeah.
Everybody got in proper queues. People were
let's
all
not
neat
mention
and clean.
The subways that were just...
Everything's immaculate, and I'm going, wait just a minute. Somebody didn't quite tell me the truth.
Yeah.
And everything was in color. Mm. It's supposed to be in black and white, isn't it?
Yeah, sure.
Especially, you know, countries like Asia, and if you go to China, a communist country.
Yeah.
That's interesting. It is a stark difference.
Sure. And
you're the first person that's expressed it that way. So, okay, so you go from China and you come to Japan.
Well, so first I did my internship in China.
Right.
I just totally caught the bug. I thought, oh my God, I want to start a company. I've got to do this in China. Went back to Chicago. I was studying Chinese in my free time, doing terrible in my classes, spending all my time running a business and studying Chinese. Then when I was 21, I had an opportunity to go to Japan. And let me preface that by saying the reason that I had always been interested in Japan is kind of a silly reason, but it's actually that sushi has always been my favorite food.
Since when?
Since like age 5. And so every year when I was growing up, my mom would be like, oh, so what do you want for your birthday dinner? Where are we going? Sushi, let's go. And we would...
What started that?
Just there was
no
starting...
Do you remember the first time? You don't remember the first time. You just remember always liking raw fish.
Not particularly, yeah. It's always just somehow my palate has always loved it. Even though I didn't even have the real top quality Japanese stuff, I already loved it as a kid. And so I always wanted to go to Japan, always wanted to check it out. And anyone who has a sushi dinner with me, they always say, oh, wow, I can't believe you're so passionate about this. And I'm like explaining the rice culture and how to cut the fish and where this one's usually there. And people just, I feel like I should have done a business with sushi, and I probably will one day. But it's just a huge passion of mine. And that was the spark. I just had this dream. I've got to live in Japan. Eat sushi 3 days a week and like just live this life.
Now, when you went to China, you were saying that you wanted to start a company because they were all approaching you to start a company.
I just caught the bug because I was in America, no one had, no one was talking about starting a business, a very few people. And it was all about, oh, how can I get into this bank? How can I get into this consulting firm? And then suddenly, here I am in Beijing, and everyone's pushing me to start a company. They're like, oh, how can we make money? We got to start something. God, it's like, holy cow! Like this is what I've been searching for, and I just caught the bug. But so then I went on the internship or the experience in Tokyo. I tried sushi at Tsukiji for the first time, and just. I mean, that was it. I was totally hooked. Yeah, I mean, I remember that first night that we were all drinking. We were going on the subway, and I'm just saying, don't worry, guys, I'll be back in Tokyo. It's going to take a couple years, but I'll be living here eventually. And so went back to the U.S. to finish university and basically set 3 goals for myself. And I said, before I'm 30, I want to live in China, learn Chinese, understand Chinese business. Second goal, I want to live in Japan, learn Japanese, learn about Japanese business. Third goal, I want to start my company before I'm 30. And then I was basically off from age 22
So
I thought a lot about it, and I really made it. I'm such a goal-oriented person. I really thought it through, and I said, I talked to a lot of people, and I realized better to go to China first. One reason is that it's actually much easier to learn Japanese if you have a Chinese background. And so I realized, okay, better to focus on the Chinese first. The cost of living in China was cheaper at the time, and for a 22-year-old graduate, that was paramount. Just of how economically booming Shanghai was at the time, and so I graduated college and just basically bought a one-way ticket to go to Shanghai, and you know, just with the idea of starting something and learning about you know, Chinese business culture. My mom was saying, "No, don't go. No, like, stay
you
here."
You read my mind, because I was going to say, "How were your parents during all this enthusiasm you had for going to Asia, the other side of the planet?" And here's their only son.
Yeah,
but your dad's kind of saying, like, kind of, look, you don't have to help me, but Grandpa, you know, wouldn't mind a helping hand.
I mean,
the Becker family's looking for you know, you're carrying our name, so. Decided to go to the other side of the planet.
There was no family business to be involved in.
Okay, I thought your grandfather, I thought the farm and stuff.
No, the thing is, my father's cousins were all running that, and unfortunately, my father's father passed away fairly young.
You told me.
So there was never a family business, any pressure like that, but. I would say my father is a relatively conservative gentleman, and he was definitely telling me to join a consulting firm, do whatever whatever my friends at Northwestern were doing. He was just trying to push me down that path, and I was saying, oh, I've got to go to China and start a business, and I'm just so passionate about this. And they were never super negative about it, but they were definitely skeptical and wondering, what are you doing? And at one point, my father was saying, "Oh, you're just not thinking about your future." And I thought, "Oh my God, that's the only thing I'm thinking about." So I was just like, "Oh, what?" I just couldn't quite understand it.
Have they turned around? Have they changed?
Oh, absolutely. My parents and I have a wonderful relationship.
You've been in Asia for how many years now?
11
years.
Yeah. 5 years in China,
I mean,
7
that's,
in Japan.
That's
total.
All the way through.
Total, yeah.
You've never had any breaks in between there?
Not really, no.
Okay.
After college, went to Shanghai, spent the first year studying Chinese, I mean, dedicated, 8 hours a day. Second year working for a Chinese startup, great experience. Really got such an amazing exposure to the culture through the young people in that company. And then I actually went to business school in Shanghai. And it was actually an American business school in Shanghai, all international students. And that might have been the best year of my life. I mean, it was just so much fun.
What was really fun about it?
I thrived at business school. I was passionate. I ended up being the valedictorian, actually. But it was this little enclave of an American business school right dead in the center of, you know, communist China, right? In Shanghai, where everything was booming. I mean, we'd be doing internships. I would see, you know, million-dollar deals getting signed every week. There was just so much going on. New subway stations, you know, popping up every month. I mean, it was just insane. And all of those students in my business school who had taken that chance to go to China, I mean, they were all very ambitious people, you know, really, really top minds, and it was just such an amazing experience. And some of those friends are my best friends to this day.
And you guys were all basically around the same age, too?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, yeah. And it was perfect. I was 25 at the time.
Did you have any girls involved in your group?
In
any
the
women?
Business school?
Yes, yes.
Oh, it was very female heavy. Yeah, I would
say.
Wait,
was it 50-50, or was it more females than males?
If it wasn't 50-50, it was 60-40 on the men's side.
On the men's side, okay.
It was probably more men than women, but it was plenty
of women.
And a lot of big personalities.
I can imagine.
Yeah, so no, it was very female heavy in business school, but it was just such a great experience. I mean, all of I lived in a traditional Shanghai house with two of my best friends from the business school. I mean, it was just some of the stories are just unbelievable. And so
you stayed there for how long?
So it was about 3 years in total. And no, the business school was actually a one-year intense program.
And then you worked with a company for 2 years.
About a year and a half or so. And then so I finished business school there, and my Chinese was actually at a pretty good level at that time. You know, business conversational, and I was kind of looking for a job, and I was considering Japanese companies, but I decided to start my second goal, which was learning Japanese. And so I actually enrolled in a Japanese language school in Shanghai, and it was all Chinese. The textbooks were all in Chinese. And I remember the first day the teacher came out and said, "All right, guys, so you got to understand, Japanese is all based on Chinese characters, so it's going to be super easy to learn." It's like, oh my God, this is great, yeah. And so, it really accelerated
my
absolutely, yeah. Okay, and so there's so many, Even unless you study both, you might not even notice, but it's about 30% of Japanese words are just direct correlations from Chinese vocabulary. And so the point is, I joined that at school, and I wasn't even there for 2 weeks. And they suddenly called me and said, "Hey, Bo, we've just got an offer from a Japanese company here who's looking to hire someone." And I had been looking for a job, and they said, and they're looking for an engineer, someone who speaks English. And they said, "Would you be interested?" I said, "Sure, yeah." So I went to this factory in the countryside. The Japanese Bucho was sitting there, Ando Bucho, who unfortunately passed away about 2 months ago. Yeah, just who was a huge mentor in my life. He was sitting there. We did the interview in Chinese, and he was like, "All right, Bo, we're looking for an engineer. You know, someone technical who speaks English and Chinese. We really want someone who speaks Japanese. But I heard you want to learn. And let's be honest, if you're here in Shanghai, it's probably not going to happen, right? You're not going to learn." So it's like, "Yeah, that's probably true." And he said, "So you join my company. We're going to send you to Osaka for 2 years, pay for your Japanese school, and then you're coming back to Shanghai and working for me." It's like, oh my God, where do I sign? Like, I just couldn't believe it. And so I got this just unbelievable opportunity out of nowhere.
They were doing what?
Oh, it's a machinery company.
Okay.
Yeah, and so I was doing their overseas business, machinery, and I had studied engineering.
Wait, did you, immediately when you got that contract, did you say, "Dad"? You called him Dad.
Of course.
This is the company I'm working with now.
And
I'm sure he was so proud he didn't know what to do.
My
son speaks Chinese. I can see him right now talking to his friends.
That was the point where it turned, because for the first couple of years it was, my son's in China. Yeah. I'm not sure what he's doing. And all his friends are saying, "Oh, my son works for this bank." But then maybe 5 years later, his friends are saying the same thing. "Oh, my son still works for the bank." And suddenly, now my son's traveling all around the world,
right,
and working
speaks
for this
Chinese,
crazy
right.
Japanese company. And,
wow.
And it was just, I just can't believe that even happened to me, because it's a family-owned Japanese business with 100 years of history. And I was right there, right? I was meeting with the Buchos all the time. I was in the headquarters in Osaka.
What was your age at that time? What was your age?
26 when I started, yeah. And so I ended up working there, man, for basically 4 years. It was unbelievable, because for the first year or so, I was mostly studying and just learning the culture, and the culture shocks were unbelievable in this company. But
give me a few examples of the
culture
shock.
So we had every morning, 8:25 a.m., the whole factory lines up in rows. The owner, Shacho, steps up, the bell rings, Shacho steps on the stage in front of everybody and says like, "Okay, order," or something like that.
Right.
And then they did a roll call of every person's name, one after, and this was the company culture, every factory did they would say everyone's name, 100 people, very fast, and you'd go, "Hi," every morning at 8:25. And then they'd do like the company announcements, and then we would all say like the company motto together at the end. And I don't think it's a bad culture.
You didn't do Taiso? You didn't know Taiso?
That company did not.
Okay, but you know, some companies do every morning.
I've been with some that did, but that was such a, just every morning for 4 years, that was what we did.
it was
amazing.
On time, all the time.
And even
what if they called a name and someone didn't say hi? What would they do then if someone wasn't there?
Oh, well, that happened to me at least once.
So what happened? What happened?
So another culture shock. I showed up late to the company one day. I had a friend visiting Osaka. Maybe we went a little too crazy on Sunday evening.
Okay.
Showed up to work late one day. Oh my gosh, right? And I mean, it was such a drama, right?
Well, tell me,
I wasn't the only one that it ever happened to, but it did happen to me maybe two times. And so you'd walk in. I mean, and the first thing I noticed was that the Japanese people wouldn't want to make eye contact with you.
So how late were you? How late were you?
Oh, maybe 30 minutes or something, right? So, I mean, that's not good, but all right. The culture shock was that the Japanese people were so scared of standing out in any way that they wouldn't want to associate with anyone who was late, even by making eye contact. And it was like, okay, guys, this is a little weird.
So what happened?
Oh, well, yeah. Well, actually, that time, I remember Shacho came directly to my desk in front of everybody and basically said, oh, in my company, this is not acceptable.
I mean, he blasted you in front of everybody.
He actually did, yeah. He blasted me in front of everybody.
Did he have you stand up while he did it, or you were still seated? You stayed seated while he stood above you.
He didn't ask me to stand up, but I did stand up. Just because I would always stand up if someone was talking to me. Right.
But you're taller than him.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. So now he changed his posture to look up at you, and he still blasted you, right?
Yeah, he wasn't. You know, he's a third generation owner,
and so he did.
But I was always hoping that maybe the guy next to me would stand up and say, "Oh, you know, he's working really hard." But no, none of that happened. And he wasn't livid, right?
He was. But he made a point.
But he definitely made it a point, and I thought, oh my God, like, yeah, this was a mistake. So, that maybe only happened once more in 4 years, but.
Okay. And he did the same thing the second time too?
Fortunately, he wasn't there that day. Yeah. And I wasn't the only one to ever.
I understand that.
That was quite an experience, but it wasn't only that. You know, other culture shocks were, you know, how did we interact with our clients? Right? What kind of dinners would we be going to? You know, what kind of activities would we be doing with the customers? How did we? You know, we would always bring gifts when we would go meet a big Japanese company, which is something you'd never do in Western business culture, right? We would, you know, just all of these little details that you might not pick up on.
What year are we talking now? Give again, it's 2000 what?
So I started 2016 and ended in late 2019. Yeah, but this was the way of doing business. And I was so lucky in this traditional Japanese company. And we had factories in India, Thailand, Indonesia,
Shanghai. Did you visit
any of them? That was my job. So I was the overseas business manager, and I ended up becoming a kacho, which was unbelievable. So if I ever write a book, that'll be the name, Gaijin Kacho.
Which is equivalent to what in English?
Manager, I guess. But it's pretty rare for a non-Japanese person to get such a title.
How many people were under you?
It was the overseas business team in Shanghai, so I think it was three people at that time.
Did they travel with you too, or did
not
they?
Typically? Because I was one of the only English speakers in the country, and so I would be going to Brazil, I would be going to the U.S., I would be going to Europe, Middle East, Africa, India.
So how much did you travel in a year?
I'm someone who keeps quite a detailed record of my life in a journal, and the record was 119 flights in 1 year. Yeah, crazy. And so I was like a United 1K member.
So it got to a point where it wasn't fun anymore.
That's true, but
at the beginning you're just so hyped and you get like this. Then after a while I'm on the plane.
Yeah, sure.
And I gotta eat this.
I've had
finished. I'm tired of peanuts now.
But if you're gonna do that life. It was the time to do it. Age 26
to
30.
Right, while you're young.
I don't regret it at all. I got to see the whole world.
Would you go back to it?
I'm pretty happy. Not traveling that much. Yeah.
So you made a good point. It's something if you're gonna do it, do when you're really young.
Yeah, it was perfect.
Get under your belt.
I was just
then going from
It would basically be every month or other month. I would organize and go on a serious 2-week business trip, which would encompass multiple markets and multiple countries. And in fact, I would be basically meeting a different factory every day. Mm. And so it was quite an adventure.
And you worked with them for how long, you said?
Around 4 years.
Four years.
I was quite successful at the job.
Okay.
I did good with the company politics. I did good with the customers. I was good at the technical side of it because we were selling custom machineries, and I loved being in the factories. It was perfect. But now we're kind of coming to the point of my third goal, which was to start my own company. And I had basically achieved what I wanted in China. I knew the culture, I knew the language, I understood Chinese business. I had achieved what I wanted in Japan. I had just had the ultimate experience in Japanese business. I spoke Japanese quite fluently at the end of that. And I had immersed myself in the culture. The third goal was to start my own business. Right, and I had always been searching for that idea, and I had so many ideas. My mom says that when I was young, I was coming up with a new business idea every other day.
Oh, so even when you were young, you used to think about
business. Sure, and I didn't even realize it, but this, and my mom says, oh yeah, he was always coming up with ideas, but during my 20s, I was always searching for that idea, and had so many ideas, but finally, the one that stuck with me came to me in Osaka. And so I remember I play volleyball, and I was at a drinking party with my volleyball team. And three of my teammates were at the bar. They were all having a drink, Japanese teammates. All of them just bright red faces, you know, from the alcohol flush, right? And so, I had some kind of anti-hangover product with me at the time and tried to make a joke. I just said, like, oh, so guys, why aren't you using this this product, a product to stop you turning red? And they all just looked at me like, oh my God, that I've been waiting for that product forever. I would love to have that. So, like, and I thought, oh my God. Actually, in the U.S., we have this kind of product, and I know about it. And why aren't you using it here? And I had to leave the party and like start making notes. And like, I was like, oh my God! And so, had an epiphany. Just got struck with this idea. Started researching while I was still working, and said there must be a company in Japan making anti-flush products. How could there not be? You know, 42% of Japanese people have this DNA deficiency, which causes them to turn red and have other problems. How could there not be a company doing this? And
I just kept looking. Is it DNA deficiency?
It's a DNA deficiency.
Is it really?
Yeah. So it's a DNA.
Not deficient.
It's actually
it's a
DNA
difference.
Defect. So which is considered a congenital disease, basically.
Really?
Yeah. And so, and that DNA defect basically causes you to have an enzyme deficiency.
That's what I was going to say. I figured it was an enzyme.
Yeah,
right.
And so the real root of the issue is the DNA defect,
defect,
which causes the enzyme deficiency.
Okay.
The enzyme that's missing is not actually for the alcohol breakdown. It's for something called acetaldehyde, okay, which is a carcinogen, and you know, quite a nasty substance that. Comes from other sources than alcohol.
Okay, right.
So there's actually a number of ways you can be exposed to acetaldehyde, and it's absolutely, you know, a disease or a defect that those people have.
So if you
unfortunately,
don't have it, you'll become so flesh of skin.
And even to go more, there's plenty of evidence showing that people with that DNA deficiency who do drink and are exposed to acetaldehyde in that way are about four times more likely to get long-term cancers, you know, liver, stomach, esophageal. As I said before, I had plenty of Asian American, Chinese American friends in college, mm-hmm. and a lot of them had this DNA deficiency and were actively taking products that are available in the US. And so it's something that most Americans know about. It's not a secret there. There's even three companies making it. And I was working in Osaka, I had this idea, started researching, and realized, oh my God, there's actually no company or product in the entire market trying to do this. How could that be? Started researching more, interviewing friends, saying, would you want this? What do you think? Started visiting factories. Whenever I had a break from work, I would just like fly off and visit a factory, say, do you think you could make this? What would we need? Started reading research papers, I was doing everything, and spent basically 2 years while still working for the Japanese company, just in all my extra time, just researching this, dedicated to this crazy business idea. And after 1 year, I realized, okay, there's no product, there's a huge opportunity, I've got to double down on this. And then after 2 years, I had a brand idea, I had already taken a trademark, so I flew to Tokyo, registered a trademark, incorporated the company, everything, and then finally, after 2 years of preparation, finally decided to go to Mr. Ando and say, I'm sorry, but I've got this dream to start this company in Tokyo, and I'm going to resign. And so, it obviously wasn't that that happy, but I did, you know, I got out of that company. Moved to Tokyo in late 2019 and founded a company which targets drinking parties and group events 3 months before a global pandemic. Oh my God. What happened, right?
you doubled down too.
Yeah, sure. Oh, I was totally invested. I had just gone through a whole process of changing my visa just to set up everything here, and suddenly there's no chance we're going to get investment, at least for the next 2 years. There's no way we can sell because no one's even going out. And so it was a pretty rough time. But I decided to basically take the opportunity to double down on product development, like brand testing, you know, doing the design of the brand, but even more actually making the product, you know, getting samples from the factory, trying this, testing that. And yeah, maybe, you know, I'm not sure I would have preferred that route, but you know, maybe it was a blessing in disguise that we had that. We basically took 2 years to just make the product.
So how were you making ends meet? Had you saved up enough? Because you said you put everything into your company.
Well, that's basically what it was, yeah. All the money I had made through my previous job and that was basically what I was using.
To keep you afloat during
that
3 years.
Yeah, sure, and I will say, I mean, I owe everything to my parents, right?
Okay.
I mean,
so they had your back.
Through that, I mean, every Christmas they're buying me clothes.
I hear you.
They're whatever I need, they've just been so supportive of it. So I'm so lucky.
We can say thank you to them. This is the camera. Say thank
yeah,
you to
sure.
them.
No, yeah. No, thank you very much, Ramadan. You made it happen.
That's beautiful. That's
don't worry. I call them every week, so that's no problem.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, so that might have been unfortunate, but in about it was November 2022 that we finally made the first product, right? And actually, I brought one just to show you.
And see if I can stop from being flushed?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, don't open it here, but...
What's the name of it?
This is the name.
Okay.
Akan. And so, yeah, we came up with a brand, yeah. So this was our first product. Yeah, we've been selling for about a year now.
And I bet it's been going like wildfire. Man, it catches on slowly.
Yeah, I'll admit that this first product is... The thing is, it's based on amino acids, vitamins, and you know, other very strong ingredients, and so it's difficult to make it tasty and make it appealing. So I think our first product didn't quite live up to the expectations in terms of taste and you know the formula of the product. And so, but I mean, whatever. I mean, it's a startup company. We're doing something completely new. And so we took a lot of feedback from the customers on that first one, and we're actually manufacturing our next product in about a month and a half. The final label was just submitted just last Friday, and I can barely sleep. I'm so excited, right? I just say
I figured you were ready for something.
Yeah, I mean, we've just come up with.
That is beautiful.
I'm really happy with what the team's come up with. It's the flavor's much better.
And is it going to have the same label? Is it going to be
no,
the same?
No, it's definitely inspired from this, but no, it's a totally new label.
What's it going to be called?
Oh, same brand name. Yeah, Akan's a great name.
Okay.
It basically tells you what the product does without making any claims. But we've come up with kind of a character, a red-faced tanuki character to be on there. We just learned so much about what the customers want to see on the label, and there's no way to figure that out without giving it a try and figuring out. So, will this next product be the big hit? I'm not even sure.
But the next one
after that, right? So,
have you gotten all the investors that you wanted? Are you still looking for investors?
We actually got our first venture capital investment about 5 months ago.
Okay.
And it was a long road to get that, you know, especially with the timing of the company, which a long, tough road. But things have been really picking up, and I think the hard work, the risk taking, actually being able to bring something to market has shown people that okay, this product actually can be sold, and because it's a medical product, that's easier said than done.
But is it called? It's not considered a medical product.
This one technically is not.
Okay.
But on that note, there's basically just as much effort that needs to go into the specifics of keeping it a non-medical product as do making it a medical product. And in some cases, especially for the Japanese market, non-medical products can be stronger than medical products, which is wild. It's bizarre, but that is the case. And so in some cases, it's actually better to do that, to do a non-medical version. But we've been working with medical factories to come up with some medicinal products. We're trying to release a tablet version of this product later this year. We've already got a factory that's making samples for us. And
tell me, Bo. Okay, so I'm out with you and I'm drinking.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm drinking.
Yeah.
I'm Japanese and I'm bright red now. Got the Akan.
Yeah, that's the idea.
I drink it. What do I expect to happen after I drink it?
Yeah.
And what type? What kind of time frame?
Yeah. So we should say, what exactly is this alcohol flush, right?
Okay.
So
you,
the facial redness is one thing, but in fact, the people with this issue, their heart rate increases unbelievably. It, you know, it goes from basically 70 resting up to like 140 with no activity, just from the alcohol. And then they're getting hives on their skin. They're getting very drowsy. A lot of them are throwing up after taking it, drinking only a little bit of alcohol. And so since our products are actually combating the root of all of those side effects, it's basically decreasing the effects of all the side effects, right? So you would take this product and then you would expect to see, I mean, from our internal testing, it's about 50% reduction of them.
Would I take it before I start drinking?
Of course, yeah.
So preventing it from happening at all.
That's the idea, yeah.
Okay, so you wouldn't wait until that, but if for some reason I forgot and did it before, then I should have another bottle so I could actually drink it.
So the way we do our in-house testing is we let them drink the alcohol first so you can see the redness, and then they drink it, and it does work, but you know, your body needs to do the digestive process of it, the metabolization. So it takes 45 minutes to really kick in. So we definitely suggest you take it before drinking alcohol.
Right. So if you know you're going to have a hard day out, go ahead.
Yeah, and it's not a complicated. The product itself is actually quite complicated. You know, from a biotech perspective, actually making it, but the concept is not complicated. We've got about 25 million people in Japan, you know, and not even mentioning the rest of Asia, who've got this serious issue. A lot of them cannot enjoy drinking. They want to go to the party. They've got pressure from their work to be drinking, but they just can't. You know, they feel terrible every time they drink. They avoid it. We even had some research showing that people with this issue are joining 60% less drinking events, just because they're worried about these side effects. And our goal is simple: give these people a convenient, tasty, affordable, easy solution so that they can just pick up one bottle or take the tablets and they don't have to worry about it. And it really is that simple.
Now, you don't have the tablets developed yet. You're developing the tablets.
Right now, they're basically, the formula has been developed.
Okay.
But the devil's in the details, right? It's okay, how big is each one gonna be?
Right.
What kind of coating are we gonna use? So what's the packaging? So we're at the product, kind of the final product development stages, and we're about to make a first test version of it. So
okay.
My company's been,
what's the name of the company? What's the name of your company?
Reiwa Seiyaku.
Reiwa Seiyaku.
Yeah, which is Reiwa Pharmaceuticals.
Okay.
I love the name of the company because we were founded in the first year of the Reiwa era in Japan, and so I love it.
Do you have a site people can go to?
Of course, reiwaseiyaku.co.jp.
Okay.
Yeah, you search for Reiwa Pharmaceuticals, you'll definitely
find
it.
I think I have a big picture of you up there somewhere in the background.
Well,
probably in the back page.
Well, check the Instagram.
Okay.
It's more on the back page.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So we've been selling for about a year or a little more, and our first product was okay, but we're about to release our second product, and I'm just absolutely pumped
all
for
the
it.
Best.
So.
All the best. But okay, before I end the podcast, there's a question I always like to ask.
Yeah.
If you could go back in time, knowing what you know now, and meet the younger Bo, and give him advice, how old would he be and what advice would you give him?
Yeah. I'm a fan of the podcast, so I actually did prepare an answer.
Right.
And I would go back to when I was 18 years old. And at that time, I had been living in Belgium for 10 years of my childhood, so actually more than I had lived in the U.S. And I had an opportunity to become a Belgian citizen, basically have to dual nationality. And I asked my family, some people close to me, and at the time I got the advice that I shouldn't do it, and which I think was not good advice. And at the time, I didn't think too much about it. I just said, okay, it's not going to happen. But if I could go back, I think I really would have taken that opportunity and become a dual citizen. I think that's one regret that I unfortunately don't have a second chance at, but that's what I would have told me to do that.
That's very interesting. Bo, thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Lance.
All the best. All
the same to you.
I want to thank all of you for watching or listening to this podcast, and never forget, it's all unknown, so continue to reach for the stars.
Because you're too blessed to be stressed.